They're going to have to talk foreign policy eventually. This is the world. I'm Marco Werman. The Democratic candidates may want to focus on domestic issues during tonight's debate, but foreign policy will come up given Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State.
There's no doubt she knows what to do when she gets that 3 a.m. phone call because she's already gotten it.
Also, why migrants are choosing the Arctic route into Europe, even if it means going through an area where Russia bans pedestrians.
No matter what your age or physical condition, you basically have to bicycle.
Plus, Playboy shocker, no more nude pics in the magazine.
If you'd asked Hugh Hefner when he started the magazine whether he thought there would ever be a time where people were bored of seeing naked ladies, I'm guessing he would have said no.
Those stories today, here on The World.
The World is brought to you with support from Audible.com. With over 180,000 audiobooks, Audible is a core tool for anyone seeking to be more productive, better informed, and thoughtfully entertained. Find out more at audible.com/theworld. And from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Glad you could be here. Tonight, the Democratic candidates square off, the first of what will likely be several debates for them. Experience tells me that foreign policy usually gets short shrift in these debates. But if it comes up at all tonight, the candidates could be talking about any number of things that we'll be dealing with on the show today. The migrant crisis in Europe, the civil war in Syria, renewed strife in Afghanistan, even the conflict in Ukraine. All that later on The World. But first to Susan Glasser. She edits Politico magazine. Glasser says a resurgent Russia is a tough one for all the Democratic contenders, especially Hillary Clinton.
She is both saddled with the reset while also going to want to try to position herself as implicitly saying, I would have been tougher on Putin than Obama was at the beginning of his term. And so that's a complicated story for her to tell. She won't necessarily be eager to tell it in tonight's debate. Perhaps the other candidates will be eager to push that narrative on her.
Yeah, I'm curious. How much do you think Secretary Clinton's time as Secretary of State just makes her bona fides unassailable in the face of the other candidates?
On the surface, right, that's one reading of it. You know, Hillary Clinton, there's no doubt she knows what to do when she gets that 3 a.m. phone call because she's already gotten it. And I do think there's a sense that she's checked every box one needs to check to meet that commander-in-chief test on the one hand. On the other hand, I think that there's a reason that Hillary Clinton has not been emphasizing her international experience on the campaign trail. It's not necessarily a huge political selling point for her, both because the politics right now are much more focused inward-looking. How are we going to get the American economy moving again? Those sorts of issues. And then there's also the question of how does she potentially distance herself from the aspects of Obama's record that she's not necessarily in favor of, or where the Democratic primary electorate has moved far away? Remember, Hillary Clinton wrote for me at Foreign Policy an article in which advancing the TPP trade deal with Asia was a key part of our quote-unquote pivot to Asia, which was the term she coined in that article. Just last week, you saw her really flip-flopping on the issue and saying that she was no longer in favor of the TPP. That reflects, I think, where the Democratic primary electorate is at.
As long as you went toward the TPP, let me ask you about that, because Clinton has recently come out against it and the Keystone Pipeline. Tricky issues for the Democrats. Why is it that for most Democratic candidates, things like this, they just can't seem to get them right?
Well, these are tricky issues. Remember, Bill Clinton faced this problem on trade and had a different position on the campaign trail than he ultimately did in negotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. Same thing with Barack Obama, who on the campaign trail was forced to sound much less free trade oriented than he has been as president, where now advancing this free trade has become pact with Asia and another one that is still being negotiated with Europe have become twin parts of his significant international agenda in his final years in office.
So really, are you saying that in a debate, candidates will say things that they'll kind of renege on later when they become elected?
Oh, that would be shocking. I can't possibly imagine it. But, you know, I think you may hear people both in skeptical questioning from the moderators and perhaps from the other Democratic candidates tonight going after Hillary Clinton on this and saying, you know, you say you're against TPP, but, you know, is that really credible? Are you just doing this for opportunistic reasons? Because I think in many ways, she's potentially more vulnerable on this opportunist critique than she even is on the question of free trade or not free trade, you know, that the substantive policy issue may be used as sort of a stalking horse, as a proxy for the questions about Hillary Clinton's character and her political opportunism that her opponents will seek to raise.
Susan Glasser edits Politico. Great to speak with you as always, Susan. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rest assured, we'll be tuning into the debate, and you're invited to our watch party. Follow at PRI The World on Twitter and use the hashtag WorldWatches to dig into the conversation. Let's move from politics in the U.S. now to politics in Russia. And politics in Russia means Vladimir Putin. Whether it's bulldozing foreign cheese or approving airstrikes on Syria, there's Putin seeming to command from on high. But at the local level, things are different. Here's a story from our friend Alina Simone about Russian politics writ small in Siberia.
My friend Sarah Lindemann is an American who moved to Novosibirsk in 1989. This summer, she started blogging about a local city council election in her district of Akademgorodok. Sarah decided to follow one particular candidate, Natalia Pinus, mother of three, successful businesswoman, head of the local community foundation. Out of six candidates, she was the only woman. Sarah says that opened her up to criticism like,
how can someone with three children have so much time, right?
Out of 39 people on the Novosibirsk City Council, only four were women. Even more unusual, Natalia Pinus was running as an independent.
All the parties except for, you know, basically the closest to a sort of a fascist party we have approached her about representing them.
But Natalia ended up rejecting Putin's United Russia, the opposition party's everyone. This meant no access to party money, while some of her opponents had plenty, like the son of a construction mogul, Nikita Galitarov.
He plowed probably 20 million rubles into his campaign.
That's about $300,000.
So you couldn't not know his name.
So instead of billboards, she asked residents to hang her banners from their balconies. Her office was a local coffee shop. Oh, and the other thing about Galitarov?
He didn't live here, didn't work here, had absolutely no connection to the community.
At the one debate, Galitarov showed up only to explain that he had a scheduling conflict and wouldn't be able to participate. The debate was streamed online, and when the online votes were tallied, Natalia was declared the winner. She held open meetings throughout the district and was the only candidate to develop a platform based on the feedback of actual residents. Her grassroots campaign was running smoothly, but so was Galitarov's, in a way.
All of a sudden, these teams of trucks and workers showed up all over town and started asphalting all the streets and sidewalks and then stamping them with four roads for Galitarov.
This was actually a popular gambit during the Soviet days.
Right before an election, all of a sudden, some little piece of street would get asphalt. People think, oh, good, you know, the guy really gets things done.
Thing is, Natalia was already known for getting things done. As head of the local community foundation, she got a duck pond constructed.
That might seem kind of preposterous, but she did something that really benefited the community.
That's Fiona Hill, a Russia expert at the Brookings Institution, who followed the election.
It was the fact that she did something that had direct benefit to her community that made her very effective and got her name recognition, not because she ran some flash campaign.
The week before the election, when it was clear the two frontrunners were Natalia and Galitarov, things got ugly. A mock newspaper was distributed, accusing Natalia of being part of the go-go 90s oligarch crowd that destroyed Russia's economy. Even on election eve, it was still unclear how the vote would go. This is a city that stunned the nation by electing a communist mayor over the United Russia candidate last April. So would Galitarov's modern version of Soviet-era politicking win the day?
I don't know, maybe it was like 2 a.m, her cell phone rang, and she was talking, and it was, you know, very serious, and then she got off, and she didn't say anything, and so we were like, who was that?
It was Galitarov, actually, calling to congratulate Natalia for running an honest campaign, and for winning. It was, by all accounts, a fair election, won by an outsider candidate without party backing on a shoestring budget. So what does it say about democracy in Russia?
It depends on how we're defining democracy. But if we're talking about grassroots participation, in spite of what things might look like at the top or the fixations of people in Moscow or in certain small circles in Moscow, people can still get things done.
If you can count on anything, count on Russian politics to confound you. For The World, this is Alina Simone.
And we stay in Russia's far north for this next story. The border between Russia and Norway, it's about the last place you'd expect migrants from the Middle East and Africa to try to get into Western Europe. But that's exactly what's happening, according to the New York Times' Andrew Higgins. He says it's not the most efficient way to get to Europe, but the northern route offers some advantages.
It's a lot safer than going by sea. You know, the sort of 600,000 people, nearly 600,000 migrants who've come to Europe so far this year, nearly all have gone across the Mediterranean, either from Libya to Italy or from Turkey to Greece. And both of those routes are very dangerous. These boats they take are very rickety and unseaworthy and frequently sink with consequent loss of life.
Yeah, and so I suppose the competition for various services from food, lodging to getting smugglers is less as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's hardly anyone up in the Arctic trying to do this compared with the huge flows through Turkey and Libya. Another reason is it's a lot cheaper. You know, if you go from Turkey, the coast of Turkey to Greece, it costs around 1,300 euro. That's $1,500 to get a boat ride, which doesn't even last that long, a couple of hours at most. Mm-hmm. But if you go to Russia, it's just a few $100 to get to Murmansk, and then you need a few more $100 to buy a bicycle, because when you cross the border into Norway, you have to go on a vehicle, and the only vehicle available is bicycle. That's because of a Russian rule that bars pedestrians across the border crossing.
That is a crazy detail. So bicycling is the last stretch of this trip. Just paint us a picture of what the whole route actually entails.
Well, the route, depending on where they come from, but most, I think, end up in Moscow and then take a plane or a train up to Murmansk, which is the big port city in the north of Russia. And from there, they get a taxi or a minibus to a place called Nikel, which is a very bleak sort of industrial town right near the border with Norway. And there they buy their bicycles and they get taken generally by taxi or again by bus to the actual border post. And then they have to get on their bikes once they've finished the formalities on the Russian side. And they cycle the last sort of 100 yards to the Norwegian border post.
That may be the most curious thing about this whole journey, that last 100 yards on bicycle. As you said, there's no pedestrian traffic. They're not in cars, so they've got to go on bike. But it's really the life of that bike is just on that stretch, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the scandals of this northern route is these Russian entrepreneurs, I suppose you'd call them, charge hundreds of dollars to buy a sort of crappy Russian bike, which is used for, you know, all of 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And then at the end of all this, the Norwegians confiscate the bikes, claiming that they're not roadworthy, or at least not up to Norwegian safety standards. And that's because they only have one handbrake. Well, in Norway, you must have two handbrakes.
Wow. It's incredible. Somebody's making a killing on those secondhand bikes at some point. What about children? I mean, how do they get across?
Exactly the same way. Kid, no matter what your age or physical condition, you basically have to bicycle.
On one hand, Russia is bombing targets in Syria to support the regime of Bashar al-Assad. What about domestically? Does Russia show any willingness to help the Syrian people once they arrive on Russian soil?
No, I mean, that's one thing that the Syrians or people who say they're from Syria all say is that the Russian official position is, of course, that they support Assad and the Syrian government, but they show absolutely no sympathy for the Syrian people. In fact, quite the opposite. They just dismiss them as sort of dirty blacks and the generally sort of racist view of Syrians. Whether, you know, most Russians really know the what a Syrian is, I'm not sure. But the Syrians who make it to Norway are not very happy with the way they're treated in Russia, not from official policy, but just the attitude of people towards Arabs.
Andrew Higgins with The New York Times speaking with me from Brussels. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up later on the show, Michael Jackson, as you've never heard him before. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like genetics, graphic design, and golf. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. From the good news, a less than good news department now, the Taliban announced today that they're withdrawing from the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The move comes after a bloody tug of war over the city between the Taliban and Afghan government forces aided by U.S. airstrikes. One man who understands the strategic significance of Kunduz is Edward Follis.
Kunduz is one of the principal export areas within the north that is a staging location for the vast majority of heroin, some opium, but principally heroin products that are transshipped to Russia.
And that takes us to the less than good news. Post 9/11, Follis worked in Afghanistan for nearly a decade as the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency's country attaché. He's now written a memoir of his time there. The book is called The Dark Art. And I asked Follis how dependent the Taliban is on opium production for funding their activities.
No less than 95%. And,
wow.
You know, oh, absolutely. This is recurring, as you know, with other insurgencies, drug organizations, terrorists, narco-terrorist organizations around the globe. They realize the exploitation of the worldwide drug enterprise supply chains and how it can be interrupted and exploited. It's fundamentally easy money for the predators in the pond.
95%. So if it was possible to stop that production, would there be a Taliban?
The Taliban would be highly localized, and they would revert back to their original organized crime fundraising instruments in their portfolio: human trafficking, arms trafficking, ransom, kidnapping for hire. Those are usually the instruments and the funding mechanisms of narco-terrorism organizations that are present when they first begin to lurch into serious violence and serious influence.
So the U.S. officially withdrew most of its forces from the country last year, intended to leave a functioning government capable of resisting the Taliban or of eliminating them altogether. What's gone wrong?
Well, you know, 9/11 invasion, that was certainly to remove the al-Qaeda training camps that were running rogue. I mean, there was over 96 training camps. The United States initially stepped in because those camps had to be neutralized. Thereafter, the thoughts, I believe, and I'm no diplomat or State Department, that is when the reconstruction of Afghanistan started, post not just Taliban, but 30 years of an absence of any government. It was pure anarchy for 30 years or occupation.
So you talked about the hunger for opium and heroin in Russia and in many of the former Soviet republics. How are they helping fight the drug trade and ergo the fight against the Taliban?
You know, the Russian Federation did not have a strong presence in Afghanistan, nor were they attempting to do so. But now they're being forced to engage, at least diplomatically, because heroin addiction in Russia is at epidemic proportions, and they see it as a great, great national security threat. Indeed, there's serious addiction and, you know, social decay, and it pushes up, obviously, through Turkey into Europe.
All of this has echoes of the drug war here in this hemisphere. Any lessons to be learned from that, a drug war that a lot of people say has failed?
Well, you know, to step into war, you have to step in to win, correct? Does anybody step into a war to lose?
Mm.
Of course not. The supply chain from the poppy fields of Afghanistan to the end user, along that route are millions and millions and billions even of dollars being generated, all resulting in the end user being the ultimate victim and the ultimate one who is exploited. That is not the place where the war should be fought. You know, I say in my book, you know, without a doubt, if you want to hunt elephants, you go where elephants live. We have no justification, even a moral pursuit of the end users. They're the ones in need of extreme government societal assistance to bring themselves out of that trench. That's not where we fight it. We take the fight right there at the source.
Edward Follis is a former U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency agent. His book, The Dark Art, is a memoir of his time in Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you heard the headline today, you might have thought it was fake, but it's not. Playboy has announced it will stop publishing nude pictures in its magazine. True, the change is scheduled to take place next spring. Playboy says that more than 50 years after its launch, the bunny transcends nudity. That is very much the case in foreign countries, but the move toward covering up its playmates isn't all about the brand. That's a word from Ravi Somaiya. He's a reporter with the New York Times.
when the magazine started, it was avant-garde, it was very progressive. Now nudity is all over the internet, and so it doesn't make that much sense for a magazine to run pictures of naked ladies anymore, especially given that it costs them advertising dollars, it makes their content less safe for work, and they are hoping that the magazine's DNA, that its strong brand, will carry it through even without the nudity.
It's weird, though. I mean, this is a business that made it thanks to nudity, and now that nudity is bad for business.
Yeah, I mean, if you'd asked Hugh Hefner when he started the magazine whether he thought there would ever be a time where people were bored of seeing naked ladies, I'm guessing he would have said no. I mean, what the magazine said to me is that it's been a victim to the forces it unleashed. Before Playboy, you know, nudity and sex to some extent were a very furtive activity. And now you just have to step outside of your home and you can see it everywhere.
Well, yeah, it's used to sell everything. I mean, the Playboy bunny is one of the most recognized logos in the world. If you go to a country like China, where there are heavy censors, what's Playboy all about there?
The weird thing is that Playboy doesn't publish any magazines in China. So it's just the brand kind of reputation and luster. 40% of their sales of licensed products come in China, despite the fact that no magazine is published there, which gives you an idea of how strong the brand is.
So we're talking T-shirts and coffee mugs?
Well, apparently the best-selling products are bath products. So it's soaps, shampoos, other
like,
things.
Like the Playboy bunny soap?
I don't know if there's directly a bunny soap, but certainly a Playboy soap.
Do you think that like people in China using Playboy bath products, do they know what the origin of all that is?
I mean, one would presume, but probably maybe not in as much detail as someone who grew up reading it in the United States.
You know, in its early days, Playboy's currency was kind of madman decadence with Hugh Hefner's cover of Freedom of Expression. I'm curious to know what you think has replaced that original decadence.
It's a very, very interesting question. There is a kind of a new breed of adult magazines which go in more of a fashion, art, photography sort of direction. They're often run by women. They're sort of more neutral in which genders they appeal to. And, you know, they celebrate all forms of decadence, not just...
Give me an example or two.
There's a magazine called Adult, actually. There's a magazine called Louis, which is kind of the French version of Playboy. But they've all become far more sort of omnivorous in their appetites, I would guess. You know, it's not so much the silk robe and the cravat as anything goes.
Yeah, don't forget the martini glass.
Exactly. Although they probably still enjoy a martini, because who doesn't?
Ravi Somaiya with the New York Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Way You Make Me Feel in Quechua, you're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. After 12 people were killed last January in the attack on Charlie Hebdo, survivors pulled together to start over. But things at the French satirical magazine just aren't the same now.
The old camaraderie, the old naivety, if you like, the innocence, has gone.
That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Soundworks.org, where you can find podcasts from PRI's The World, including The World's Daily Podcast and The World in Words with Patrick Cox, exploring language in all its glorious complexity. Subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Yesterday, we told you how many people in the Netherlands were awaiting the first official report into what happened to Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. You'll remember that plane was en route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur last year and exploded in midair with nearly 300 passengers and crew, mostly Dutch, on board. Today, Dutch investigators released that report. The big finding? The Boeing 777 was shot down by a Russian-made Buk missile over eastern Ukraine. One Dutch official says he believes the missile was fired from territory controlled by pro-Russian rebels. Moscow is not happy with the report and offered its own interpretation today, as I heard from reporter Charles Maines in Moscow.
Well, you know what the Russians did? They had the arms manufacturer of the Buk missile system present to a sort of an international corps of journalists here this morning, just about an hour before the Dutch investigation, and they presented sort of an alternate version of findings, essentially acknowledging that the Buk missile was part of this, explained the crash, but saying that essentially it was fired from Ukrainian-held territory. So the big issue is they focused on who actually fired the missile rather than just the downing of the jet airliner.
Yeah, were you convinced by the arguments made by the manufacturer today?
You know, it was a little bit bizarre. I mean, they had this kind of blur of graphs and charts, and I think you really needed probably an advanced degree in mathematics and physics to sort of follow the whole thing. But they also, there was sort of the strangest moment of the whole thing was a series of videos that were sort of very kind of eerie, where they'd in fact basically found a sort of replacement, sort of stand-in plane that was an old Soviet edition. And then they blew up Buk missiles in repeated ways to sort of test the shrapnel patterns and things like that. And, you know, technically, I guess, it was designed to sort of prove their findings, but it was sort of hard not to watch that and just think of, you know, the lives lost and what was happening really with the real MH17. So it sort of emphasized more the carnage, I think, than the sort of technical aspects that the Russians were hoping to bring across.
And just clarify for us what this missile manufacturer actually said. And they said the missile came from the Ukrainian government.
Well, what they're saying is that there are sort of two points to their argument here. And one of them, they say, is that I think it's pretty clear to a lot of people that the Russians were out to sort of usurp the Dutch investigation by sort of pointing the finger away from Russia. There have been a lot of accusations that the Russians, certainly Russian-backed rebels may have fired this missile, and secondly, Russia may have actually given the missile to the rebel-backed separatists, if not participated in the firing of itself. So at this press conference today, you saw two kind of conclusions. One of the main ones was, in fact, that this Buk missile system was an older version, a Soviet-issue edition that actually the Russian army says they don't use anymore. And I think the implication here being that the Ukrainian army would use it. And the second part of this was also just saying that, look, if we looked at the way that the sort of splay patterns of shrapnel on the front end of the plane, on the left wing, essentially they were saying from the point of impact, this couldn't have been fired from where the Dutch investigators say it was, meaning that it was, in fact, from a territory at that time, what the Russians say was held by the Ukrainian army.
Now, the mass media in Russia is pretty much controlled by the state, by the Kremlin. How are they presenting the story?
They really focused on the science here. They've sort of talked about how, you know, one of the other messages I think that came across from today's press conference and certainly has been relayed by state media was that, in fact, you know, that the Russian investigators or the Russian sort of missile team was willing to present all these findings to the Dutch investigation and that their sort of analysis and their data was refused. So what the Russian media is saying is like, look, we're still willing to give the Dutch the opportunity to look at this data that we've collected, but it sort of completely upends the Dutch conclusions from today.
So it looks like this was most likely a terrible accident, misidentifying MH17 as hostile aircraft. No one's saying anyone intentionally wanted to shoot down a commercial airliner. Why is the Kremlin so keen to distance itself then? I mean, what's the big concern about just coming clean and saying, sorry, not to excuse it, but war is hell and mistakes are made?
Well, I think it's about, you know, once you go back on the story about MH17, you go back on the story about Crimea, you go back on the story of Eastern Ukraine. You know, the problem is that, you know, this is from the Russians' point of view, and this is the line that we've heard from the Kremlin and through state media, is that the Russians were fighting fascists in East Ukraine, defending East Ukraine from fascism and from sort of a junta in Kiev, that there were Russian speakers in danger in Crimea, and that's why they had to go in there. And all this stuff becomes part of the sort of grand narrative. And I think that suddenly sort of presenting yourself as the bad guy here, even if it's on a mistake, just doesn't go over well. So, you know, it just may be one of those narratives that they just have to stick with as long as Mr. Putin's in office.
Reporter Charles Maines there in Moscow. One key question raised by the Dutch report on MH17, why was the airspace over eastern Ukraine not closed? Dutch investigators concluded that Ukrainian authorities had sufficient reason to completely close the airspace, but nobody gave a thought to the possible threat to civil aviation. Di Whittingham is a former senior officer in Britain's Royal Air Force and is currently head of the UK's Flight Safety Committee. So there had been multiple instances of warplanes being hit in the weeks before the MH17 disaster, Di, even at high altitude. So why was the airspace over eastern Ukraine not closed?
It's a very good question. We, of course, look at it with hindsight, and it's easy looking back now to appreciate that it should have been closed. But back then, of course, there had not been an instance where somebody had actually had a go at a civil airliner, because with these sophisticated air defence systems, they come with a command and control setup that allows people to identify the target they're shooting at. In this instance, of course, the people in control of that particular weapon system were not under the control of anybody else, and therefore probably did not have the command and control information available to them to allow them to work out that that was actually a civilian airplane.
Now, if a country does not close the airspace, airlines can make their own judgment calls, right? Because there were lots of commercial airliners that were going around eastern Ukraine, correct?
They were, but there were also an awful lot going through it. And this comes back to the risk assessment that people make, the operators make, when they look at an area that they are overflying. At that stage, they determined there was no real risk to them because nobody had told them there was. There was no information available to them at the time that suggested that high-level military traffic was being taken out as well. So you can understand perhaps why some of the operators took the decision they did.
Yeah, but if you're an airline pilot and just reading the headlines, you think, oh, we're going to be flying over eastern Ukraine, maybe that's not such a bright idea.
You might think that. You certainly would today. There is now a repository for information which allows governments to tell the civilian aviation community that there is an issue with their airspace. They should, of course, close it if they can't guarantee safe passage through it. But sometimes they don't. And, of course, not all governments are willing to contribute to that repository, which is a source of, I know, of concern for the international organization.
Even today? I mean, how much did all this change with MH17? Did the protocols get tightened up by everyone?
Yeah, the protocols did. And the website, I think, went live in April. So the information repository for conflict zones allows any state to input information about conflict in its area to allow people to make an informed decision as to whether they go through, over, or around.
I mean, there are so many conflicts around the globe. I mean, I recently flew from Frankfurt to Mumbai, and a straight line would have taken me over Syria, but deviating to the north might have taken me over Ukraine. So how much do pilots actually kind of consult this repository before taking a flight?
The pilots are unlikely to be consulting the repository. The people that plan the routes and do the risk assessments certainly will be. And of course, for any nation, whether that's the US or whether that's the UK, there are systems where the intelligence services will provide information to operators that they might not wish to release to other people because of the way they've gathered that intelligence.
So today, how safe is the system?
The system is much safer than it ever was before. People now have access to more information than they did. And more importantly, the people making the judgments on whether a risk is acceptable or not have retuned their levels on it. They will be much more risk averse when it comes to a conflict area where you know there are heavy weapons, sophisticated air defense weapons that are no longer in formal military or government control.
Di Whittingham, who is the head of the UK's Flight Safety Committee, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Ever heard of Renata Flores? She's an indigenous Peruvian, a teenager, but she's also an internet sensation, thanks to a video that went viral of her singing a Michael Jackson hit. Jenny Monet has our story from Peru.
Renata Flores is finding her voice, and it's kind of one she never expected. This is her singing the Animals' 1964 hit, House of the Rising Sun. Not in English or in Spanish, as you might expect from someone living in Peru, but in the language of her ancestors, Quechua. The lyrics were translated by her grandmother.
This is the Quechua fue para un objetivo, para que los jóvenes y niños...
Singing in Quechua has a purpose, to give a message to young people, to tell them that we need to put worth into our language, Quechua, that we don't have to feel ashamed of it because it sounds pretty, right, in songs or in poems.
At 14 years old, Renata is only now beginning to learn Quechua, one of 47 surviving indigenous languages in Peru. It's also one of the country's oldest dialects, descended from the Inca more than 800 years ago. Next to Spanish, Quechua is Peru's second most spoken language, with an estimated 4.5 million speakers. But it's not taught in schools, and those fluent in it are mostly older people of the rural Andes, whose sons and daughters have grown up largely rejecting Quechua.
I believe maybe they attach it to poverty, and they don't put value into it. But that's not right.
Back in August, Renata struck a chord after posting a music video on YouTube. Seems a lot of people around the world could relate to a girl going back to her roots. She sang in Quechua to Michael Jackson's The Way You Make Me Feel, set against the backdrop of ancient Inca ruins. The video has since been viewed more than a million times. At school, Renata's basically a celebrity. When I met up with her in her home city of Ayacucho in the Peruvian Andes, a group of elementary students had showered her with colorful confetti and white roses. Others held signs that read things like, "Renata, you make us proud." Renata's teacher, Rudio Rojas, says a lot of the kids want to be like her, and that her singing has even led him to rethink his own indigenous identity.
Well, I'm going to be honest. When I went to the capital city, I was ashamed of the Quechua. People would ask me, "Oh, so your parents speak Quechua?" I was like, no, I was denying it. Sometimes I feel embarrassed now for not speaking Quechua. They were rejecting of my family and the door to the past.
Peruvians have struggled for years to accept their indigenous heritage. Ethnic discrimination in the country has gotten so bad that the Ministry of Culture launched a racism hotline in 2013.
¿Alguna vez tuvimos un poco de miedo?
We thought about, okay, maybe Renata can be discriminated against.
Renata's mother, Patricia, feared for the worst for her daughter. But even so, she's been behind the Quechua campaign from the very beginning. Just last month, she and a network of family and friends threw Renata her first concert at a theater in the center of Ayacucho. It was put together in just 3 weeks, in the midst of all that social media buzz. The showstopper? Renata's performance of Falling by Alicia Keys, sung in both English and Quechua. And there was something else that stood out on stage that night. Renata's pink wool hat, known as a chuyo, with dangling ear flaps that hung down to her waist. It's a style of hat that indigenous Andeans have been wearing for centuries.
Bueno, será para revalorizar.
Yeah, it's part of this adding value to our culture. But I wanted a symbol for me that identifies with the Quechua and me.
It's a symbol of both indigenous pride and awareness, starting with a new generation in Peru. For the World, I'm Jenny Monet in Ayacucho, Peru. Thank you.
Just ahead, Fear and Loathing at Charlie Hebdo in Paris, here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Journalism, you may have heard, is in dire straits. Layoffs, whole newspapers shutting down, a million microblogs. Even so, it's kind of startling to hear one newspaper staff compared to a bunch of unhappy soccer stars looking to transfer to another team.
There's been so much, you know, public dispute and squabble that one French journalist said it's like watching a football team in transfer season.
My BBC colleague Lucy Williamson there in Paris telling me about the staff of Charlie Hebdo, the French satirical magazine that was attacked by two gunmen with links to Al-Qaeda last January. They killed 12 people. The most likely motive? The magazine's frequent depictions of and jokes about the Prophet Muhammad. Lucy Williamson says the assault provoked an outpouring of solidarity with the magazine.
I think people all over the world were focused on the magazine, were watching as the surviving staff, you know, clung to each other during the memorial services, and one of the staff members describing how important it was for them to get together and talk together, hug each other, and put the next edition of the paper out. There was a real determination to keep going. And really, 9 months on, it's a very different picture indeed. The newspapers here in France have been full of the comings and goings at the two very high-profile departures that have been announced just in the past few weeks.
I even heard that the paper finally, after decades, became profitable after those massacres. Is this an economic thing, or is it kind of more about the editorial content?
I think it's lots of things together. I think it's the fact that you're dealing with a group of people who've been through such a serious trauma creates in itself pressures that the newspaper had to deal with. It lost 3 out of 5 of its editorial directors, including high-profile founder Sharb. And at the same time, they've had to deal with new pressures. There's lots of criticism from some staff that the editorial line has changed. But the money question you mentioned is also really interesting. You're right that the paper was struggling before the attacks and after the attacks because of the renewed subscriptions, because of the uptick in people buying the paper, and because of donations. It's become one of the wealthiest newspapers in France, reportedly.
Wow.
And the difficulty that many staff members have with those funds, that it's not money that's been honestly earned, if you like. It's money that has come as a result of something that many of them still find very difficult to talk about and very difficult to process.
Kind of sympathy money, in a way. Has the magazine continued to depict images of the Prophet Muhammad?
There's been some controversy about that because one of the most senior cartoonists, Luz, has said he won't draw the Prophet Muhammad anymore. Now, he is also someone who's said he's going to resign from the paper. He's obviously got some issues with continuing. But he said he wouldn't draw the Prophet Muhammad because he was no longer inspired by him. Now, the other person to come out and say that is the new director, Rhys. And he's come in for some criticism by some staff that maybe there is this attempt to be slightly less confrontational, to avoid drawing the sort of focus that they drew before.
You know, there was a lot of criticism pretty recently of Charlie Hebdo's decision to publish a cartoon depicting that dead Syrian boy washed up on a Turkish beach, Aylan Kurdi. Is that kind of the mood right now at Charlie Hebdo? No one really knows where the organization's line of decency is anymore?
I think it depends who you talk to. It's very difficult with a newspaper to really gauge how many of the staff are behind which faction, if you like. I mean, any news organization has these kind of editorial disputes. I think at Charlie Hebdo, they've become particularly sharp because its editorial board has been decimated and because of this large amount of money, that the idea of who controls that money, who decides how much goes to the victims, how much goes to the paper, is still a very live one. Those are all things that are swirling around at the paper at the moment. And it's a perfect storm, if you like.
And I gather they've also moved into new offices. Is it safe to say that the attack on Charlie Hebdo in January has just prompted second guessing about personal security?
Yeah, they've spent most of the past year at the offices of the Libération newspaper in Paris. They've moved into their new offices now. You're dealing with, as I say, a very traumatized surviving staff who are still living under very difficult conditions. They're not free to come and go as they want. It's very difficult for many of them to work in the way they would like to work in. Even at home, there's a fear of snipers, there's a fear of intruders. They have to live with their curtains drawn. They live in the dark because they're too scared to open the curtains, let the sunlight in, for fear of being seen, for fear of being targeted. And they have, many of them, round-the-clock security with them all the time. It's been suggested that may be behind some of the decisions to leave the paper. And it's very difficult to tease out exactly where one issue ends and where the next issue begins.
What do you think the future of the magazine is?
Well, there's a real commitment to keep going with the magazine. It's now financially secure, so that's not a problem anymore. But I think what some people feel is that it has been fundamentally changed in the process, that the old hierarchy, the camaraderie, the old naivety, if you like, the innocence has gone. And for many people who lived through those years, that's very difficult. One of the columnists who told us he was going to leave by the end of the year said that for him, Charlie Hebdo is dead. And it may well be that the magazine carries on and thrives, but for him, it was over, and he had to know when was the right time to leave.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson speaking with me from Paris. Thank you very much, Lucy.
Thank you.
The outlook and vibe in Paris is decidedly different for an ensemble of musicians caught in a sort of time warp. This is Caravan Palace. If their techno gypsy swing sounds a little familiar, maybe it's because you heard their sounds recently in an ad for Diet Coke. But the group's beginnings were far less commercial. Caravan Palace was created in order to produce a soundtrack to a long-forgotten vintage porno film from the Victorian period. Who knew that would lead to success right up the French pop charts? Their 2008 debut hit number 11 in France and stayed on the charts for more than a year. And this year, they performed at Coachella. Not bad for a band whose influences range from Cab Calloway to Daft Punk. Legs, ain't got time to lay low. Your knees are bending, so it's time to get up and let go. Hey, how's it going? Can see your body moving. Don't leave the party. Yep, you can see my body moving, because it is. French darlings Caravan Palace taking us out today with music from their brand new release. The album's title is, actually, it's just an emoji. It looks like some dude chilling out. I don't know how to pronounce it. That's all I can tell you. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can make it tomorrow. Baby, can you move around the brother? Because you know I'm living in the last days. Speed up, it ain't no gate. Just turn up all the beams when I come upon the scene. That good old sound is ringing. They don't know what they're missing. Legs, ain't got time to lay low. Your knees are bending, so it's time to get up and let go. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence, by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund. And by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. PRI, Public Radio International.